From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis, host for this special edition of Press Conference USA. Here in the U.S., we mark February as Black History Month. It is a time for paying tribute to the generations of African Americans who struggled with and overcame adversity to reach numerous accomplishments and achievements and contributions that have played a central role in U.S. history. The celebration of Black History Month began as Negro History Week, which was created in 1926 by Carter G. Woodson, a noted African-American historian and publisher. It became a month-long celebration in 1976. The month of February was chosen to coincide with the birthdays of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. Today, we are going to delve into a part of U.S. history that people know little about, and it starts right here in the nation's capital. Some historical facts regarding African-American achievements in Washington, D.C. include the fact that enslaved black men built the nation's capital, the White House, and other famous Washington structures. For example, Philip Reed, a 39-year-old slave from South Carolina, cast and helped space the model of the Statue of Freedom that sits on top of the Capitol Dome. The National Mall sits on the former site of the city's most bustling slave market. And another interesting fact is that what is now known as Arlington National Cemetery was from 1863 to 1888 a self-sustaining village for former slaves called Freedmen's Village. Well, joining me for more insight into the contributions of African Americans to Washington, D.C. and the states of Maryland and Virginia is distinguished scholar in residence at the Library of Congress and author of Black Men Built the Capitol, Jesse Holland. Among some of his many contributions, Mr. Holland was one of the first African American journalists assigned to cover the Supreme Court full time and only the second African American editor of the Daily Mississippian, the college newspaper of the University of Mississippi. Also joining me on the panel today is VOA senior TV correspondent Chris Simpkins. Chris specializes in coverage of African American issues and produced an amazing series here at VOA to mark the 400th anniversary of the landing of the first enslaved Africans in Virginia, entitled Retracing the Paths of the First Slaves in Virginia in 1619. Well, welcome to you both. And Mr. Holland, give us just a little bit of a geography lesson here. You mentioned in the preface of your book that Washington, D.C. would not exist without Maryland and Virginia. So actually, there are some places in Washington that really stand out. And one of them that you mentioned in your book is East Capitol Street and First Street Northwest. What is the significance of this location?
Well, we know this location today because that's where the U.S. Supreme Court sits. That's the Supreme Court building. That was a building where I worked in for about 5 or 6 years. But while I was in that building, I would always think about the African-American history of that location. Well, first of all, where the Supreme Court building sits in the Library of Congress used to be an African-American neighborhood. This is where African-Americans lived. But the significance of that site is that where the Supreme Court building is now used to be where the old brick Capitol was. Now, this building was where the U.S. Congress met while the current Capitol was being constructed. So when they moved from the old Capitol to the current Capitol, they still had to find a use for the building. So they made it into a prison. So the old Capitol building on the site of the U.S. Supreme Court building now used to be a prison. This was a prison where the conspirators in the Lincoln assassination were held. But it also was a place where fugitive slaves were brought in and held until their masters could come get them. Now, D.C. sits in between Maryland and Virginia, so it was a way station for many runaway slaves. So D.C. facilities, the prisons, the jails, they would be where they would hold the slaves until the masters could come back and get them, or the slave hunters would deposit them there until they could be returned to their masters. It's just an amazing fact that the site where we determine today which laws are constitutional or not was the same site where African-American slaves, enslaved African-Americans, were held while they were being returned down south to Virginia and other southern states. It was just an irony that always hit me when I was inside the Supreme Court building. And there's no marker to that. The only marker at the Supreme Court building right now is a marker that says this used to be the site of the old Capitol. But it doesn't mention that it was used to hold escaped slaves.
That is very ironic because, as you said, historical decisions affecting African-American life were made and still are made inside the Supreme Court. So the fact that it is sitting just right at that particular site.
Exactly. This, like I said, there are a lot of places in D.C. where you can find little ironies like that. In fact, at the base of Capitol Hill, where the U.S. Capitol faces the National Mall, there used to be a hotel that Southern lawmakers would come up from the South. They would stay in this hotel. The hotel would advertise in the newspaper that it had jails in its basement where you could hold your slaves, where you wouldn't have to worry about them running away while you're conducting the business of the country. And these sites and stories like that are all around Washington, D.C., and they're just waiting for people to realize that they're there.
Wow, very interesting. And Chris, I know you had a location that you wanted to mention.
Yeah, Jesse, we talk about the city and we look to the other end of Washington, D.C., and we find Georgetown University, one of the premier universities in our country, not only built by slaves, but appointed one of the, or the first African-American president.
Well, this one of the amazing stories that we can tell about Georgetown University. Well, I have to say up front, Georgetown is where I teach now. I teach journalism ethics at Georgetown's School of Continuing Studies in the Masters of Journalism program. But this is one of those incredible stories. One of Georgetown's original presidents, President Healy, Patrick Healy, I believe his name was, he was actually African-American. What happened was Healy was from down south, Georgia. His father was white, but his mother was black. But he himself was very fair-skinned. So his mother sent him from Georgia up north to be educated. And when he came up north, he then no longer mentioned that his mother was black. Now, of course, knowing by the laws of the United States at that time, one drop of Negro blood meant you were black. But Healy did not talk about this. So he goes on and he becomes president of Georgetown University. And actually, one of the main buildings at Georgetown University is named after him, Healy Hall. But for his entire life, he never actually brought up who his mother was. But his status at Georgetown makes him one of the first African-American college or university presidents in America's history. And Georgetown talks about it now. Georgetown actually is doing a lot of great work when it comes to its slave history. The students are putting together a fund to help the descendants of the slaves who were used to build Georgetown attend school there. The school is putting together a reconciliation committee so the school can grapple with the fact that this mighty institution of learning in the United States is only there because of slaves who were used to build the campus. The school is working right now to acknowledge that fact and find ways to reconcile itself with the fact that it used slaves in the construction of its buildings.
Very, very interesting. Also, another location, or I would say another building, well known as Union Station.
Union Station.
Now, Union Station is Washington, D.C.'s train station. It's a major hub for tourists, travelers along the eastern seaboard, and commuters such as myself who go through the station every day to go to work and to get home. So what is the African-American contribution to Union Station?
Well, one of the things that you can say about Washington, D.C. is that it's doing a great job to reconcile itself to what it is today as opposed to what it was in the past. I first moved here to Washington in 2000. When I moved here, there were very few representations of African Americans in statuary around Washington, D.C. But one of the places that actually did have one was Union Station. And that was a statue, it's still there today, of a bust of A. Philip Randolph. We should all know who A. Philip Randolph is. But A. Philip Randolph was the head of the Union for Train and Transportation Workers. In fact, he was one of the people who put together the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King came to Washington and gave his I Have a Dream speech. That was A. Philip Randolph putting all this together. So it's appropriate that a bust of him is in Washington, D.C.'s main transportation route. Every time you go there, you want to get on an Amtrak train, you want to get on the commuter train, you should pass by A. Philip Randolph's bust, and you should give thanks to him for the work that he did, not only to bring African Americans fair treatment in the transportation of the United States, but for the work he did on the March on Washington, which I don't think he gets enough credit for.
Good. Thank you so much. And Chris?
Well, in your book, you not only concentrate on Washington, D.C., but the surrounding area. And one of those areas is Northern Virginia. And as a small kid, I remember going to Mount Vernon, Virginia, which is the stately home of our first president, George Washington. I did not know that slaves at the time, slaves built Mount Vernon, and that Washington was a very large slaveholder. And at the time of his death, hundreds of slaves. Talk about Mount Vernon and talk about one of the slaves there, Wes Ford,
right,
who is credited with preserving a lot of history of that location.
Now, one of the things that where African Americans don't get enough credit for is, especially in the South, a lot of what we know about these huge plantations like Monticello, like Mount Vernon, comes from the surviving enslaved Africans who lived there. A lot of people don't think about it a lot when it comes to slaveholding presidents, but President George Washington had hundreds of slaves. And he continued to hold slaves all throughout his presidency. Now, George Washington himself, when he entered his marriage with his wife, did not own many slaves. It was through his marriage with his wife, Martha, that he all of a sudden has hundreds of slaves at Mount Vernon. Now, Wes Ford was one of his favorite slaves. So Wes Ford was one of the few people that we know to this day is actually buried at Mount Vernon. Because Wes was a favorite, we'll just call him a favorite of George Washington. Now, there are some people who claim that Wes Ford is possibly a relative of George Washington because of the favorite treatment that Washington gave him. And there's actually an enclave outside of Mount Vernon called Gum Springs that was founded by Wes Ford, and his descendants over many years continued to live there. But Wes Ford's story stays pretty much at Mount Vernon. George Washington actually took slaves with him when he left Mount Vernon to become president of the United States. The capital at that point was New York. George Washington would take slaves with him from Mount Vernon to New York, and then following that to Philadelphia to serve as his body servants. That basically means butlers, and serve as cooks and as his presidential staff. In fact, George Washington became the very first president, not only the very first president, but the very first president to have a slave escape from him during the presidency. It was a woman named Oney Judge. This was while Washington was in Philadelphia. Whenever you took a slave out of Virginia to a northern state like Pennsylvania, where slavery was illegal, you could only keep the slave in that state for 6 months before the slave would automatically become free. So what did George Washington do? He didn't want to lose any of his Mount Vernon slaves. So every 5 months and 2 weeks, he would leave Philadelphia, go back to Mount Vernon, and then go back to Philadelphia to start the clock all over again. So as the end of his presidency comes, his slaves see the possibility of going back to Virginia and never becoming free. Oney Judge had a separate problem. George Washington had promised her to a family who lived in Virginia as a wedding gift. So she was in Philadelphia with this huge Black American community of freedmen, and she's seeing a life of slavery waiting for her in Philadelphia. So one evening, while they're having dinner, Oney is asked to bring something to the Washingtons from the kitchen. Oney goes to the kitchen, walks out the back door, gets on a ship, and sails to Rhode Island to her freedom. Now, that isn't the end of her story. Washington actually hired slave catchers who went all the way up north to try to drag Oney Judge back home. They actually found her. Unfortunately for the slave catchers, the town around her told her that the slave catchers were coming, and she was able to get away from them, and she died a free woman. President Washington and Mount Vernon, you have all of these great stories.
Wow, that is. That's very dramatic. And we're going to take a short break right now. You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Jesse Holland, distinguished scholar in residence at the Library of Congress and author of Black Men Built the Capitol. Also joining me is Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent. This is a reminder that our PC USA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And a new VOA English app for both Android and Apple devices has been developed, and we encourage you to download and use them. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Now returning to our program as we highlight African Americans and some of their contributions to American history. Now also, there's another location. There are so many monuments and memorials, as you say, to mention, but Theodore Roosevelt Island National Memorial. It sits in the middle of the Potomac River. Now, Roosevelt was the 26th president of the United States, and as you note, he was known as an outstanding naturalist and outdoorsman. He preserved more than 234 million acres of national parks, forest monuments, and wildlife refuges. He also established the U.S. Forest Service, and he was the first president to refer to the White House officially as the White House. First, what is the historical significance of this site? And secondly, Roosevelt was famously associated with a toy here in the U.S. called the teddy bear. So how is this history related to an African American?
So there's so many great things we could talk about President Theodore Roosevelt with, but let's just start with the one thing that we as Americans talk about all the time and we don't credit him, and that's the teddy bear. He was actually the inspiration behind a teddy bear, behind the teddy bear. But and there's an African American related story to that as well. We all know that Theodore Roosevelt was a big game hunter. He loved to hunt. He was an environmentalist, but he was also a hunter. So he actually travels down to Mississippi, and he wants to go on a bear hunt. Well, there is this famous African-American U.S. Marshal named Bass Reeves. So when Roosevelt comes down to Mississippi, the Mississippi officials don't want to be embarrassed and have Roosevelt not find a bear. So they hire Bass Reeves to go find one, and he does. But this bear also has a cub. So he brings this bear and the cub to President Roosevelt, who falls in love with the cub. And when the story's reported in the paper, they start calling the cub Teddy, where we get teddy bears from. But that bear would never have been there if not for the African-American lawman named Bass Reeves. Now, the second part of the story here was there is an island that's in the Potomac between Washington, D.C. and Arlington National Cemetery called Theodore Roosevelt Island. But that isn't its original name. It was originally called Analostan Island. The interesting thing about this island is that during the Civil War, even though African-American soldiers were used by the North, the U.S. Army still discriminated against them. They couldn't live in the same areas with white soldiers. So the U.S. Army had them live on Theodore Roosevelt Island, back then once again called Analostan Island. So that was the training ground and living quarters for the U.S. colored troops that were used in the battles of Gettysburg and the battles of Bull Run. That's where they lived and they worked, on Theodore Roosevelt Island. Now, a second interesting thing here I want to throw in really quickly, that if you go into Arlington National Cemetery today, even though, once again, they were members of the military like everyone else, back then, even Arlington National Cemetery was segregated. So Section 27, if you go into Arlington National Cemetery, and just as a hint, it's the section nearest to the Iwo Jima Memorial, you will find a complete section of the cemetery that's nothing but U.S. colored troops and enslaved Africans who escaped from slavery but died in this area. They're all buried in the same section. Every time my wife and I take our children to Arlington National Cemetery, we not only visit our relatives, but we go over and pay honor to the U.S. colored troops who are still in their own section in Arlington National Cemetery.
Fascinating story. Chris?
We talk about the government buildings that were built in Washington, D.C. by slaves, but there's also connections to several religious structures. One is nearby my neighborhood where I live in Washington, D.C. That's the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception. Tell us about what we might be able to find in this beautiful, very stately looking church.
Well, first of all, the basilica is absolutely beautiful. And if you haven't had time to go over to the Basilica in Washington, D.C., you really should. If my memory still serves me correctly, I believe it's the third largest church in the United States. That's just incredible. But if you go into the basilica, down in the crypt of the basilica, you will find Our Mother of Africa Chapel. And that was a gift to the basilica from the African-American Catholics in the United States. This was the first chapel in the National Shrine that was dedicated to African-Americans. And the sad thing about this only happened in the 90s. So this is not something that's been there for a very long time. Once again, it shows the changing that we've done in the Washington, D.C. area, where things in the past where African-Americans were not recognized, we're actually doing these things now. We actually started this show out by talking about Black History Month and Carter G. Woodson. There's actually a statue to Carter G. Woodson in Washington, D.C. now, but it's only been there for about 10 years. And Carter G. Woodson was the father of Black history and was a dean at Howard University. But there was no statue to him. There is now. And it's like I say, it's one of those things where we're doing a much better job in Washington these days of recognizing the African Americans that made not only this city what it is, but made this country what it is.
And that's very interesting because you see so much of this going on right now with them really trying to bring to light a lot of the contributions of African Americans and African American slaves. So how can teaching U.S. history be made more interesting? I personally would recommend your book as part of a history class. Class for even elementary school children.
Right. Well, one of the things that we have to do when we're teaching history in the United States is we have to make history more inclusive, especially when you're teaching ancient history. For some kids, including my own, anything that happened in the 1990s is ancient history. But when we're talking about Civil War era and back, we have to make sure we're telling stories that include everyone. When we grew up, we usually were only taught history about white males. But today, we can make sure that we include everyone. We can talk about a Benjamin Banneker. We can talk about a Garrett Morgan. We can talk about Harriet Tubman. We can talk about Sojourner Truth. We can talk about not only Black men, we can talk about Black women. And these are the stories that our children relate to. We want to be able to see ourselves in our history, to be able to say, I can do that. And so if we include more of America's true diversity in history, we'll find kids will be more interested in learning about it because then they can see themselves. That's not how we were taught. We're just learning about this in history right now. Those untold stories of African-American history, that makes people want to learn more. And that's how we get kids to learn about America.
Absolutely, Chris.
And I guess those traditions are born out of the belief that if African Americans were to take their rightful place in American society, people of all races should learn about Black contributions to American history. One of the other interesting spots you talk about in your book is Freedom's Memorial. Tell us about Freedom's Memorial and the contribution some free slaves made to this memorial or monument as it stands now.
Okay, so if you're in Washington, D.C., and then you're at the U.S. Capitol, if you look east, straight down East Capitol Street, you'll run into Lincoln Park. Lincoln Park is there, and in the center of Lincoln Park is Freedom's Memorial. Now, there are a couple of interesting things about Freedom's Memorial. Remember earlier when I was talking about there were only a few representations of African Americans in Washington, D.C.? Freedom's Memorial is actually one of them. In Freedom's Memorial, it actually is a statue of Abraham Lincoln. And in fact, it was the first monument to Abraham Lincoln that was put up in the United States after his death. African Americans from around the country dedicated their money toward getting this statue up. Now, it wasn't only African Americans, but the first donation to that statue came from an African American woman. And so they put together this statue. And it's a statue of Lincoln standing with his hand outstretched. And at Lincoln's side, on down on his knees, is an African-American man. That is actually the representation of a real African-American. His name was Archer, and he was one of the last slaves who was freed in the United States. So when they put together this statue, they wanted to not only have Lincoln, but they wanted to have the representation of one of the last slaves to be freed in the United States. So they used the image of a real African-American. It's his face in the statue. All of that is interesting enough, but there's even more to the story. Lincoln is in the center of Lincoln Park, and he faces west toward the U.S. Capitol. At the east end of Lincoln Park, there's a statue of an African-American woman. That is a statue of Mary McLeod Bethune, the famous educator. We all have heard of Bethune-Cookman College down in Florida. It's named after Mary McLeod Bethune, who was one of the first African-American women to serve in the U.S. government. So when the District of Columbia put Mary McLeod Bethune into Lincoln Park on the east end, that meant that Lincoln, who was in the center and facing west, had his back to Mary McLeod Bethune. He was facing the Capitol, but his back was to Mary McLeod Bethune. Well, there came a bit of a hue and cry because Mary McLeod Bethune was a significant African-American. Not only a significant African-American, she was a significant American. People in the District of Columbia said there's no way that President Lincoln would turn his back to a woman like Mary McLeod Bethune. So what was done? Lincoln actually was picked up and turned. So today, Lincoln's back is to the U.S. Capitol, and he's facing, in the east end of the park, Mary McLeod Bethune. So Mary McLeod Bethune and Abraham Lincoln are now looking at each other instead of Abraham Lincoln looking at the U.S. Capitol. This is one of those great stories about Washington, D.C.
It is. That is very, very fascinating. Now, just looking ahead to the future, what do you see in terms of preserving more of this type of history and really getting it out there? How do you think it should be done?
Well, we're seeing more and more work being done to catalog African-American history, not only in Washington, D.C., but around the country. Just recently, the state of Maryland put up statues to Harriet Tubman and Frederick Douglass in the Maryland State Capitol in nearby Annapolis. Washington, D.C. is working on getting statues of Sojourner Truth and Harriet Tubman in the U.S. Capitol as their statues. As each state gets two statues in the U.S. Capitol, they're trying to get two African-Americans as their statues in Washington, D.C. And of course, you have the Martin Luther King Jr. National Monument, and you have the Smithsonian National Museum of African-American History and Culture on the National Mall. So we're seeing the stories of African-Americans taking more and more space on the National Mall and in Washington, D.C., and more importantly, in Americans' minds. In the past, our stories were always the footnotes. Our stories were always the also, this happened, but now we're learning how significant African Americans have been to the history of this country, and we're acknowledging it. We're not just being told it, it's being recognized. And as we go forward into the future, I'm looking forward to not only hearing about more African American men, but more African American women. We're looking forward to those stories being told loudly and proudly as we learn our true history of the United States.
Excellent. And Chris, I'll let you get the last word in.
Well, I'm heartened by that, too, because I've traveled around the United States and I'm seeing more African-American museums in smaller communities. They're not just here in Washington, but in communities like Memphis, Tennessee, Cincinnati, Ohio, Montgomery, Alabama.
Right. The one I'm really looking forward to is the one coming up in Charleston, South Carolina, which will be the International Slavery Museum. We know, as we well know, Charleston, South Carolina was a huge market for slavery, just like Alexandria, Virginia, just like New Orleans. But there are very few museums that deal directly with the issue of slavery. And that's what they're going to do in Charleston, South Carolina. And I can't wait to see it.
Okay, great. Good. Well, of course, we could go on with our discussion as there are so many different facets to this subject, but we will end on this note. And I would like to thank our guest, Jesse Holland, distinguished scholar in residence at the Library of Congress and author of Black Men Built the Capitol. Thank you for bringing to light so many truths that for so long have gone unknown. And thanks to my colleague, Chris Simpkins, VOA senior TV correspondent and producer of Retracing the Path of the First Slaves in Virginia in and 1619. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America is produced in Washington. Our engineer is Justin Thwaites. I'm Kim Lewis, host of this special edition of PCUSA, and be sure to join Carol Castiel next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.